Hello and welcome to the Semantic Cybersecurity Brief, our fortnightly podcast where we discuss all things cybersecurity. I'm Dick O'Brien and joining me today once again is Semantic Threat Researcher Bridget O'Gorman. First of all, welcome back because this is our first podcast after our summer break. We are going to resume recording on our usual schedule of every 2 weeks from now until December. And we certainly have a lot to talk about today because there's never going to be a sleepy summer in cybersecurity, and this year has been no exception. So in this week's podcast, we'll be talking about the refocus and retooling by the Russian cybercrime gang Evil Corp, and a pretty revealing piece of new semantic research about the security, or should I say lack thereof, of the mobile software supply chain and how poor practices can lead to the exposure of a worrying and in some cases shocking amount of data. But first, let's turn to what has unfortunately been one of the big cybersecurity topics of this year, and that's the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Bridget, you've been keeping an eye on the situation and indeed you've been closely involved in some of the updates recently.
Yeah, thanks, Dick. Over the last couple of months, I would say we definitely saw the invasion's, I suppose, continued impact on the cybercrime landscape. And as you say, we ourselves published a blog a couple of weeks ago while we were off air, detailing some activity by the Shookworm APT group that was aimed at organizations in Ukraine. Now, Shookworm, which is also known widely as Gamereddon or Armageddon, they're a Russia-linked group that has almost exclusively focused their operations on Ukraine really since they first came on the scene in around 2014. And they are generally considered to be a state-backed espionage operation, so a typical kind of APT gang. So the activity that we saw, it was ongoing at least as recently as the 8th of August, and it has likely, you know, continued since then. The activity that we saw at the time, it was consistent with activity that had been previously reported by the likes of CertUA, and it seemed to be consistent, I suppose, with Shookworm's aims in general, with the likely purpose of the activity being cyber espionage. In this campaign, we saw Shookworm download three variants of the same PowerShell stealer onto a system, with it likely downloading the different variants, which all more or less had the same capabilities, in an effort to avoid detection or evade detection. I suppose if one was detected, then the others might, you know, still have the ability to gain persistence. And we also saw a drop an unknown info stealer as the final payload on another organization's network. And that info stealer had, you know, various kind of typical capabilities, such as recording audio using the microphone and then sending that back to a CNC server, taking screenshots, logging and uploading keystrokes, as well as being able to download and execute files, and as well as load DLL files as well. And the attackers, they most likely gained access to victim networks via a spear phishing email campaign, from the evidence that we found, which is also kind of quite typical infection vector for Shookworm. And we did see the known Shookworm tools, backdoor.peterito and backdoor.godome being deployed on the victim networks as well. And I suppose the activity that we saw in this particular campaign, it wasn't hugely kind of novel, but it was interesting in that it, combined with previous reporting on this group as well, it did show some patterns in how the group is operating at the moment. You know, it's using files that contain ntuser.dat in the file name, using various artifacts that contain names like judgment in the file name, as well as leveraging executable files whose file names contain English words that start with D, like dat, decay, declare, etc. And I think as well, this activity, it was also interesting because of the fact that, you know, CertUA had published their findings before we published this blog, you know, and this activity, it continued even after that CertUA documentation. And I think it shows pretty clearly that, you know, fear of exposure certainly doesn't deter Shookworm from its activities. And, you know, as I said, in all likelihood, its activity aimed at organizations in Ukraine is probably continuing as we speak.
Yeah, and I guess this is part of a broader picture because there's been lots of other stories over the past few weeks relating to Russia and Ukraine that you want to discuss.
Yeah, I thought maybe we'd chat about some of the kind of things we've seen while we were on our podcast break, although not on a full work break, let us be clear to point out. But yeah, so I think some interesting things have come out, include kind of some interesting kind of, I suppose, statistics and kind of research into the kind of impact of the Ukraine invasion on cyberspace. So at the Black Hat conference in August, Victor Azora, who is the deputy director of Ukraine's State Service of Special Communications and Information Protection, kind of made a surprise appearance, and he described the invasion as perhaps the biggest challenge since World War II for the world. And he also underlined the kind of impact on cyberspace. He revealed that the country, that Ukraine, had logged more than 1,600 major cyber incidents to date in 2022. So I suppose that was probably in the first kind of 7 months of 2022. He said that the attacks peaked in March and April of this year in the immediate aftermath of the invasion, when we did see several waves of wiper attacks that, you know, we've discussed many times in this podcast and blogged about as well, and when they saw the kind of those waves of attacks being launched. Interestingly as well, around the same time, Fortinet also released a report outlining how it hadn't found more than one wiper a year since 2012. And that there have been multiple years where they haven't found any wipers. However, in 2022, multiple wipers have been found. You know, off the top of my own head, I can think of, you know, obviously there's Whisper Gate, Hermetic Wiper, Caddy Wiper, you know, and there's more as well. And all of these have been used against Ukraine. So I guess when you look at those kind of statistics from Fortinet, it does just demonstrate, I suppose, the kind of scale of the activity we've seen really in the last, you know, year.
Yeah, and then I guess on the other side of the coin, I think it seems that the impact of hacktivist attacks, which were talked an awful lot about in the early days, were probably overstated as the invasion has moved on.
Yeah, so a research paper came out about this, I think it was in August, and it was produced by academics at various UK at universities, University of Edinburgh, the University of Cambridge, and the University of Strathclyde. And the paper found that the narrative, as you say, about committed hacktivists and kind of, you know, patriotic cyber criminals contributing to cyber attacks against, you know, both Russia and Ukraine was perhaps overplayed. And the paper found that hacktivist attacks motivated by the invasion of Ukraine have in fact been minimal, with attackers really only showing a brief interest in the conflict, and these attacks being primarily quite low impact and somewhat unfocused as well. So the researchers said that the conflict briefly but significantly caught the attention of the low-level cybercrime community, and they did say that there were initial DDoS and defacement attacks seen. However, they did say as well that these attacks, they were these kind of mass attacks, they were targeted really at random websites. Any websites with domains like .ru or .ua were targeted, with no evidence of really kind of high-profile attacks by hacktivist actors occurring, and also that interest in attacks targeting either country by hacktivist actors it waned quite quickly, and within weeks of the invasion taking place, according to the researchers. And this is a pretty big piece of research. The team analysed 281,000 web defacement attacks, almost 2 million DDoS attacks, and more than 400 discussion threads from 2 months, the 2 months before, and the 4 months after the invasion. So it was quite a comprehensive piece of research. So it is definitely, I think, interesting in that regard.
Yeah, the attention span didn't last long.
No.
But we have seen some apparent Russian cyber attacks hit some of the countries that have voiced support for Ukraine as well.
Yeah, and this is definitely kind of an interesting development in everything that's going on as well. So officials in Montenegro blame cyber attacks that occurred quite recently, just at the end of August, and which they said threatened the nation's critical infrastructure on Russian hackers. So these attacks, they reportedly crippled government-run transportation services and a lot of online platforms for information, as well as some water, transport, and electricity systems. And the public administration minister for Montenegro, Maris Stuka, he told state television that the attackers had created this, what he described as a special virus for the attack called Zero Date. And he said that 150 workstations in 10 state institutions had become infected with this malware. The country's defense minister was the one who publicly blamed the attack on Russia initially in its immediate aftermath, telling local media that he thought there was enough to suspect that Russia was behind the attack. And then Montenegro's National Security Agency also told the media that it had evidence that multiple Russian agencies were involved in the attack as well. And this attack, it led to the US Embassy in Montenegro issuing a security alert about the incident, and the FBI has also said it will be sending a team to Montenegro to help investigate this attack as well. And Montenegro, which is a member of NATO, it had frequently expressed its support for Ukraine since Russia's invasion of that country began earlier this year. And in another incident then, a little bit further back in July, we saw a Lithuanian energy company being hit with a series of DDoS attacks, which also appeared to be in apparent retaliation for the country's support of Ukraine. So in that case, the Lithuanian energy company Ignitis Group said it was hit by what it described as its biggest cyber attack in a decade, and when numerous DDoS attacks were aimed at it, disrupting its digital services and its website. Now, the attack was claimed by pro-Russia hacking group Killnet, and this was the latest really in a series of attacks that had been launched by that group in Lithuania since the Russian invasion of Ukraine began. Lithuanian organizations have been hit by multiple cyber attacks since they began enforcing the EU sanctions on goods traveling to Russia. However, in this case, Ignatius Group said it was able to manage and also limit the attack's impact on its systems, and that no further kind of breaches were recorded outside of the kind of DDoS disruption. But I do think that, you know, the targeting of countries that have expressed support for Ukraine like this is definitely something to watch, I would think, you know, especially as we head into winter. And I suppose the kind of increased impact that, you know, any disruptions to things like energy or electricity supply or anything like that can have on, you know, countries, particularly those in Eastern Europe, as we've seen in the past, you know, years ago, when obviously the Ukraine's power supply was affected and stuff back in 2016. So some interesting times ahead, perhaps.
Yeah, I think it's a very real fear amongst a lot of organizations, and the fact that the precedent is there with the attacks on Ukraine itself. You know, I think those fears are not far-fetched. Again, and then finally, perhaps a less expected consequence of the invasion, there was an increased number of Chinese espionage attacks being aimed at Russia.
Yeah, and I did actually mention this kind of possibility when I was writing our kind of China Cyber Espionage Actors white paper earlier this year. But we got some research from Kaspersky in August about a Chinese cyber espionage group that Kaspersky said was using 6 different backdoors to target a range of organizations in the military, industrial, research and government sectors in Belarus, Ukraine and Afghanistan, as well as Russia. According to the research, at least a dozen organizations were compromised in this campaign, and the attackers used spear phishing emails to compromise their victims. Interestingly as well, the attackers apparently used all 6 backdoors at the same time, and they most likely did this in order to maintain, you know, the communication channels within the compromised systems in case one of the backdoors was detected and removed. The attackers, you know, they did kind of typical sort of cyber espionage activity, moving laterally across networks. They were aiming to hijack domain controllers and so then obviously obtain control of or all of organizations' machines, basically. And then they would search for and exfiltrate data from the infected systems, basically. And I suppose this discovery, you know, it is further evidence of what it does appear to be something of a pivot by Chinese espionage actors to go after Russian targets, which does appear to have begun shortly after the invasion of Ukraine. And I suppose it is kind of notable, as I suppose perhaps before this, China and Russia may have been, you know, perceived as allies of a sort, you know, with cyber attacks, kind of espionage attacks aimed kind of, I suppose, between the two countries, you know, reasonably unusual to see reported.
Yeah, it's fascinating, all right, you know. I mean, it kind of gives an indication as to how surprised the Chinese were maybe by the invasion, you know, that they feel the need that they need to get a better handle of what's going on, and that they were maybe blindsided by it. But it's interesting maneuvers.
Yeah, they're keeping an eye on things now anyway. Mm-hmm. But I think now, Dick, we will turn to another piece of research that we ourselves recently released as well. And it was kind of maybe slightly unusual research for us to release because it was all about the security of the mobile software supply chain.
Yeah, and it's pretty interesting, and it seemed to get a lot of people's attention. And I think when you read it, it's probably not surprising why it did. So the research was done by our colleague Kevin Watkins. He's a threat researcher who works on our mobile security team. And Kevin's put out a lot of good work in the past year or two, and we should really try and get him on the podcast sometime. But in the meantime, let's talk about what he's done here. So essentially, he analyzed a whole load of apps, and he managed to identify nearly 1,000 mobile apps that have a security vulnerability within them, and that is namely hard-coded credentials for AWS, which, as most people know, is Amazon's cloud service. And the reason, by and large, why these hard-coded credentials are there usually isn't because the app owners or the developer put them there, but for the most part, they were introduced at some point further up the mobile software supply chain. So what do we mean when we say mobile software supply chain? I guess the best way of explaining it is that the owners of most apps don't usually start from scratch with a blank slate. And there are certain building blocks that you can work with, such as software libraries and software development kits, known as SDKs. And developers can draw from them to quickly build out what they need. So that's one point in the chain. And then another point in the supply chain is the developers themselves, because often they aren't in-house. An organization will often outsource its app development to a specialist who is a third-party developer, who may often end up using the same tooling and the same infrastructure for all of its clients, which means that sometimes a vulnerability or an oversight in its security is introduced into all or many of the apps that they develop.
Yeah, so I think what I found surprising in this research was how common this appears to be. I mean, surely at this stage, we all know that, you know, hard-coded credentials are a bad thing. So how come so many developers appear to be leaving them in apps?
Yeah, I mean, it is quite stark, the amount of apps that Kevin found. I guess the reason it's so common is that for the most part, the credentials are left there intentionally. But what is not intentional is the amount of data that is exposed by these credentials. And secondly, that there are also better ways of doing what the developers want to do than just simple hard coding. So I'll try and explain it a little bit better. There will be cases where an app may need to call upon a resource or some data that's in the cloud. And obviously the app will need to authenticate itself to make that request. So for example, you could have, say, a voice translation app on the phone. So you speak into your phone, it records a clip, and then it delivers a translation of what you've said in whatever language you're looking for. But that translation doesn't happen on your phone. Instead, the recording is uploaded to the cloud. It's translated there, and then the translated voice file is sent back to you. So in this case, the intent behind having hard-coded credentials would be giving the app the means to authenticate itself and access that cloud service for translation. So you may ask, what's the problem with hard-coded credentials? Well, the main one is that all too frequently, those credentials will also provide access to data that is beyond the scope or the needs of what the app requires. So in short, they could give you access to stuff that you're not meant to see. But now that could mean anything. It could just be it could be user data relating to that app. It could be source code. It could even be data relating to other apps and services. Or indeed, it could be like everything that developer has up on AWS. It gives you access to. So Kevin analyzed a little under 2,000 apps where he found hard-coded credentials. And of them, three quarters of them contained valued AWS tokens that allowed access to private AWS cloud services. And of them, about half of them contained valid tokens that gave access to the full kind of account, where there were numerous files, in some cases millions of private files available on Amazon S3.
Yeah, so I can see why this would kind of alarm people, this kind of research. So I suppose maybe, Dick, can you maybe give some examples of the kind of information that was exposed then?
Yeah. I mean, it's good to kind of see the real world impact. Kevin had a few detailed case studies. And for example, he found There were several popular banking apps on iOS that relied on a single third-party AI digital identity SDK, and that essentially handled biometric multi-factor authentication. So embedded in the SDK were some cloud credentials, and they provided access to the private authentication data and keys belonging to every single banking and financial app using that SDK. So this is the example of like it being beyond the scope of the app's requirements. You just needed it to authenticate that fingerprint, and next thing you're getting access to data and keys belonging to other banks and other apps. But furthermore, the user's biometric digital fingerprints that were stored and used for authentication, along with their personal data, like their names, their date of birth, and all that, they were also exposed in the cloud and accessible using those hard-coded credentials. So Kevin found over 300,000 biometric digital fingerprints that amounted to, I guess, the user base of five different mobile apps using that SDK. They're all accessible using the hard-coded credentials that are in that app.
Wow, okay, so it's pretty big impact.
Yeah, it's once you start reading that, you kind of go, okay, this is non-trivial, this is pretty serious, and this is like the kind of data that nobody ever wants exposed, you know?
Yeah, definitely not. Yeah. So I suppose then, I mean, we're saying hard-coded credentials are bad really and shouldn't be used. Well, I guess maybe an obvious question then is, are there any circumstances where hard-coded keys are okay? You know, like if a developer ensures that data is, you know, very carefully siloed and the hard-coded credentials only provide access to what's required by the app to function.
Yeah, I mean, you can certainly say that it's much better than using a single set of credentials for all of your infrastructure. But in some ways it's better, but from talking to Kevin, it's clear that it's still not best practice. And that's simply because harder coded credentials are a long-term thing. And if you need to change them or whatever at all, it needs to be manually revoked. So from his perspective, a much better way of implementing this is temporary security credentials that expire after a short period of time. And he pointed out that there's loads and loads of documentation about this and guidance and best practice documents from AWS and from other cloud providers. It's all the information you need is out there. Developers just need to go away and start reading it and start following it.
That sounds like good advice, all right. But that's definitely really interesting research. So I hope people go and read it on the blog because it's definitely an interesting one.
Yeah, it's a great piece of work.
I think maybe let's turn maybe to some of the other things going on in the world and talk about what's in the news this week, because I think one thing you did want to mention was retooling by the cybercrime gang that's known as Evil Corps.
Yes. I mean, there's loads of stuff going on since we last spoke, but this one kind of caught my eye this week. Because Evil Corp is a group that we haven't heard much about in recent times. But they seem to have changed their focus once again, and they have lots of new weapons in their arsenal. So by way of background, Evil Corp, which I should stress is a name that they gave themselves. We call them HISPID. Some other vendors call them TA-505. They're one of the most long established cybercrime groups in the world. They've made, it's fair to say, hundreds of billions of dollars over the years. They started out running the Drydex banking Trojan, which was, I think, for a few years, it was one of the chief threats being distributed. And that's when they really started earning big money. But then they moved on to ransomware, and they were behind a wide array of ransomware threats, such as BitPamer, DoppelPamer, Wasted Locker, Grief, you name it. But I think what's notable about this group is how well known they are They're based in St. Petersburg. They've been photographed a lot driving around in some very, very expensive cars. And they've been, they're wanted by the FBI, and they've been identified, they're on the wanted list, they've been indicted. And in fact, such has been the law enforcement focus against them that they're now the subject of Treasury Department sanctions, which means that anyone who does business with them, including paying them off, could potentially be guilty of an offence in the US. And those sanctions were the most likely reason why they frequently rebranded their ransomware in recent times, because it seems that they were worried that their victims, if they knew who they were dealing with, wouldn't pay up lest they fell afoul of sanctions. Anyway, the ransomware activity appears to have died down a while back, but it's now quite evident that they haven't gone away. And instead, it seems that they've retooled and refocused, and they've gone back to, I guess, what their original modus operandi was, which is theft rather than extortion. So in this case, it's stealing money from bank accounts and now cryptocurrency wallets.
Okay, so what kind of attacks then are they? Are we seeing them carrying out now?
Yeah, there's been a few bits of research that come out this week that provide a lot of detail about their current operations. So first of all, there was a report from the French security firm Prodaft, who said that the group is now using a framework called TeslaGun. This is a name that the group gave it to themselves, and they're using that framework to manage malware known as ServHelper, which is a backdoor that they have managed to infect at least 8,000 organizations with worldwide, nearly half of which are in the US. So ServHelper has been known about for a while, and it's your standard backdoor, which provides the attackers with persistent access and can be used to potentially push other malware onto the victim's network. And it looks like the main distribution method for this threat is phishing emails. So what's TeslaGun then? It's a software control panel that the group uses to manage its infrastructure or its entire network of infected computers, and it gives them a detailed dashboard with all of their infected victims, and it allows them to kind of mark them all up with some comments and tags and filter them by tags. And it's evident that Prodaft has had a good look at this dashboard, because they said that Hispid, they appear to identify some of their victims as suitable for further exploitation, but then others are marked up as sell, which presumably means they've been selected as candidates to be sold to other cybercrime groups, where that's where they sell the access to the company's network to another group, which is often for ransomware or something like that. So for the victims that they do kind of exploit further, as I said, it's theft. They're going after bank accounts, crypto wallets, as I mentioned earlier. But they've also been seen installing coin mining software on some infected networks.
God, I feel like coin mining software is a bit of a blast in the past nearly at this stage.
Indeed. And it's not the only blast from the past that we're seeing with this group.
Yeah, because they've also introduced a USB worm.
Yeah, it's kind of odd because it's a real old school type thing. So the malware is called Raspberry Robin, and it's a worm that spreads by infecting shared USB devices. The malware is essentially a loader. And the ultimate payload remains unknown, but it has been seen delivering Sokolosh malware, which has previously been used by this group as a precursor to ransomware. It's an interesting threat. Raspberry Robin has been known about for some time, but there was some research this week from IBM who made a solid enough link to Evil by comparing code from Raspberry Robin to code from Drydex, which is, a known Evil Corp tool. And there was enough kind of crossover there to make it likely that there's some kind of shared authorship there. So I mentioned this kind of threat is rarely seen nowadays, you know, primarily because awareness of USB security is much, much higher and it's better. But according to IBM, at least, it's proved to be surprisingly effective. So they said that the malware had made its way onto the networks of 17% of its MDR clients in the oil and gas manufacturing and transportation sectors, which is, you know, a not insignificant proportion. So yeah, it's interesting to see a USB threat kind of make a comeback like this.
Yeah, that's quite a high percentage, really, especially when you think who even uses USBs that much these days.
Exactly. You know, because yeah, people just use various cloud accounts and various other kind of collaboration platforms to share files. So yeah, you know, I don't know when I last used the USB drive. No. But yeah, one to watch, I think, you know. Okay, that's about all we have time for this week. But if you've been enjoying our podcast, don't forget to subscribe to avoid missing out on all of our future episodes. You can also follow us on Twitter at Threat Intel. And if you'd like to read our latest research, including our work on Shookworm and the security of the mobile software supply chain, you can check out our blog, which can be found at semantic-enterprise-blogs.security.com/blogs/threat-intelligence. We'll be back again in 2 weeks' time, but until then, thank you and goodbye.